1. The Art of Real Power. Nancy Pelosi has a killer instinct, something I never had. Well, not much of one anyway. In fact, I think she may be the most powerful Speaker of the House in my lifetime, maybe the most powerful ever. There are many reasons I say this, and some I'll get into in a moment. But one that really stuck with me involves one of her former Democrat colleagues in Congress, a legendary fixture on the Hill, the late, great John Dingell. John was the so-called Dean of the House, the longest-serving member, having been first sworn in under President Eisenhower in 1955. He was a World War II veteran and remained a favorite of both sides of the aisle due to his charm, sharp tongue, his eccentricity, including his punchy embrace of Twitter in his 80s. He was also chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. To those of you with normal lives who live blissfully outside of Washington, this may not seem like much. But sitting on a big, powerful committee like this one, known as ENC for short, is a major deal on Capitol Hill. And becoming chairman, well, that's what people in Congress live for. You get to hold hearings, issue subpoenas, investigate pretty much whatever the hell you want if you come up with a reasonable pretext. And Dingell was ferocious in that job. Tough, nasty, powerful. People dubbed him Big John and the Truck. Personally, I like the guy a lot. We met in 1991, my first year in Washington, at, of all places, an NRA press conference. For some reason, we quickly struck up a conversation which turned into a friendly relationship over the next 25 years. He was a great guy to spend a few minutes with sitting on the House floor, to ask his advice, or just hear him wax on about the institution of the House, for which he had a great love. When he came to office in 1955, it was in a special election to replace his own father, who had died in office after serving since 1933. The place was in his blood. He grew up with it. His depth of knowledge was amazing. For this reason, lobbyists, CEOs, presidents, fellow members of Congress, and everyone else who happened to cross his path were scared as hell of John Dingell. Everyone except Nancy Pelosi. Sometime after Pelosi became Speaker, her fellow Californian, Henry Waxman, made what many of the smart set in D.C. saw as a surprise move to unseat Dingell as chairman of that committee. There were a couple of things that may have motivated Henry. Maybe it was an ideological thing. Dingell was a Michigan moderate who didn't follow the progressive line on issues like climate change and auto emission standards. Waxman, on the other hand, was a staunch liberal, a Watergate baby, a member of the large class of Democrat representatives who came to office in 1975 in the wake of President Nixon's resignation and voters' general dissatisfaction with Republicans. As the second highest ranking Democrat on the committee, Waxman had been waiting his turn to take over the chairmanship for years and years, and maybe he just got tired of waiting. Anyway, when Waxman announced he was leading what at first seemed like a nutty suicide mission against Big John, Pelosi stayed officially neutral. But anyone with two peas between their ears knew that Henry wouldn't have dared to challenge Dingell without Nancy's approval. He certainly would not have won, which he did, without her tacit support. She didn't have to say much, and she didn't show her hand in public. Nancy's one of those people who doesn't leave a lot of fingerprints. But she was all over this. I could just smell it. Waxman's 15-vote victory made all of our next snap upright. Pelosi had gutted Big John Dingell like a halibut she found floating around San Francisco Bay, and then calmly sat back and had a cup of coffee afterwards. His entrails were left on display for everyone in the House of Representatives to see and to remember. I don't think Nancy relished mounting Dingell on her wall. She certainly didn't brag about it, but that's not the point. The point is, she did it, and I have no doubt she slept just fine that night. After the gutting, there wasn't much of a role for John Dingell. It's hard to leave a perch that powerful and still feel relevant. Nobody was afraid of him anymore. He retired from Congress in 2015 and died a few years later. When his funeral mass was held at Holy Trinity Church in Washington, Pelosi was speaker again. She attended, but she did not give a eulogy. I spoke, as did a number of John's former colleagues. But the highest-ranking Democrat to address the mourners was Majority Leader Steny Hoyer. I didn't often agree with Nancy's politics, Well, I pretty much never agreed with her, but I respected her. Her family had political power in Maryland, but she moved across the country and came up in California politics on her own strength. In many ways, she and I chose similar paths once we got to the House. She set out from her first term, just like I did, to join the leadership. And she got there, just like I did, in part by throwing herself into fundraising for her colleagues. She was a formidable political operator who knew how to count votes and dollars, an essential skill for building coalitions in a nuthouse like Congress. She knew how to tell the difference between bullshitters who promised their support and people who would stick by you until the last dog died. When she became Speaker the first time, she held her entire conference in line, passed Obamacare, and wielded power with sometimes ruthless enthusiasm. I like Nancy, don't get me wrong, but while we may have taken similar paths to the speakership, I'm still not sure I could have done what she did to poor John Dingell. And it wasn't just Dingell. There was a pretty sizable pile of victims on the Democrat side of Congress that Nancy Pelosi turned into virtual non-persons. Pelosi understands power, and she's not afraid to use it. And that gets me thinking a little bit about what this concept of power really means, especially in Washington. Ever since I came to our nation's capital, I've heard people babbling about power. You always hear the same phrases, the corridors of power, the power players, the most powerful this or least powerful that. They can go on and on. Listen, I'm not about power. I've never been. I couldn't care less about it. Well, I guess that's not wholly true. And maybe more precisely, I couldn't care less about conveying an image of power. Being powerful is like being a lady, Margaret Thatcher famously put. If you tell people you are, you aren't. People running around calling themselves powerful look about as ridiculous as those telling everyone they're a genius. That's why President Trump didn't do himself any favors with his declaration that Article 2 of the Constitution gave him the power to do whatever I want as president. All that does is leave you vulnerable to attack from people who want to prove that you're wrong. As Speaker of the House, second in line to the presidency, I was considered a pretty powerful figure in town. Most of the time, I found this an annoyance. I couldn't always do what I wanted, like go play golf or go out to dinner with some friends without making some U.S. Capitol police officers tag along with me. The black SUVs, the security detail, I guess some people would call these trappings of power. To me, they were just embarrassing. Sometimes it was nice to speed through a stoplight if I was late to a meeting or pull up to an airplane right on the tarmac, rather than having to go through security lines and wait for my seat to be called. But sitting in some entourage, followed around by people with sunglasses and guns all day, that's not my style at all. I often felt like I had to justify the extravagance. It's hard to just veg out at home and watch TV when people are keeping you under some 24-hour surveillance. The taxpayers are really paying some guys to stand outside my house while I watch TV. Give me a break. I wish I had thought of the term executive time when I was speaker. But Trump was way smarter than me on that one. Maybe one of the reasons I've been reluctant to embrace the power label is that I saw how quickly and casually power can be abused. Not just by world leaders like Nixon or Clinton or whoever, but by ordinary people like me and you. Something happens to a lot of good people when they start to feel powerful. As for the bad people, well, power just makes them all the more dangerous. I saw it time and again in Washington. Some people could barely hold power in their hands for a hot second before they became jackasses, using either for their own gain or somebody else's loss, or both. The way the House leaders abused the power to take advantage of the already dirty earmark process, in which members basically were bribed with special pet projects in their districts to vote in favor of legislation, was one of the worst examples. But there were plenty of others. Some members would wait years to settle scores with people over some minor grievance, like voting against a bill of theirs. Maybe it's a little ironic that one of the biggest abuses of power I ever witnessed ended up propelling me to a more powerful position of my own. I've been a member of Congress less than 9 months, when, in September of 1991, I stumbled across a little item in USA Today. They reported that a federal agency, the General Accounting Office, GAO, had done an annual audit of the House of Representatives Bank. Yes, we had our own bank. It wasn't even a bank, really. It certainly wasn't regulated in the way every normal bank in America is regulated. It was just a little operation run out of the House Sergeant-at-Arms office, dating back to 1789, where members' paychecks were deposited, and from which members could then write checks. But the GAO found that members had bounced thousands of checks without penalty. Nobody seemed to have paid much attention to that story, but I did. I hadn't liked the idea of a house bank from the moment I heard of it. When I first showed up, they tried to get me to set up an account for my paycheck. No thanks, I told them. I like my bank back in Ohio. I'd been dealing with them for years and saw no reason to switch. You can't do that, I was told. The only way you can get paid is to have an account with the house bank. Well, that got me nervous. I didn't like hearing that there's only one way, through one entity, to get something done. These guys had created a nice little monopoly for themselves. My nose started twitching, and it just didn't smell right. It turned out I wasn't the only one who felt that way. Charles Taylor, another freshman Republican from North Carolina, had a similar experience. Charles owned banks back home, and he understandably wanted his check wired to his own institution. But like me, he was told you couldn't get paid unless you took part in this little venture. So Taylor and I talked to a few of our other freshmen we knew, and started asking around more generally, and here's what we found. Nobody had been in Congress for any length of time seemed to want to talk about the House Bank. Some members would start looking at their shoes whenever you mentioned it to them. Well, we figured out what was happening. The House Bank was a sweet little perk for all these guys. They were letting people overdraw their accounts with regularity. At home, if you had $0 in my bank account, I was out of luck unless my bank gave me a loan and charged me interest. Here in Congress, if I had $0 in my account, I could just write checks and someone else would pay for it. I guess you'd have to pay the House Bank back at some point, but nobody seemed to be too bothered by that. And guess who paid for this great perk? Well, the American taxpayer. The rest of you were footing the bill for members who couldn't balance their own checkbook. Why this came as a surprise to me, I couldn't say, but it did. And I wanted all these guys to admit it. One day, Scott Klug from Wisconsin and I, with Rick Santorum from Pennsylvania, introduced a privilege resolution on the House floor, a special measure brought up outside the normal calendar of House business that demanded an explanation of what was going on with the bank. The Democrats controlled Congress at the time, but I like to think we would have done the same thing if it were Republicans. I'll be honest, the fact that Democrats were up to their necks was a nice cherry on top. When the leadership found out what was actually going on, they converged on us. Speaker Tom Foley came down to the well of the House, as did Majority Leader Dick Gephardt. But then it turned out the Republicans weren't innocent in all of this. Our Republican leader, Bob Michael, joined the group as well. They really seemed to be against our resolution being introduced. In general, their explanation sounded like, "We didn't do anything wrong, and we won't do it again." We were going against the most powerful people in Congress, so we needed to turn to people with immense power of their own, the press corps. The press gets such shit from members of Congress, often deservedly so, but they were the ones who first brought this scandal to light. We guessed that the American people would not like the idea of their representatives passing bad checks with taxpayer money. As we expected, once the story got out, it not only grew legs, but also started running all over town and into pretty much every member's office on Capitol Hill. By Monday, the story of a few freshman congressmen exposing the cover-up in the House Bank was everywhere, and people were pissed off. Americans were pissed as hell at Congress, our colleagues were pissed at us, and by Tuesday, the House voted to close the bank and ship the whole matter over to the Ethics Committee. We had gone against the most powerful people in the House, but now the power had passed to us. And here's how I knew it. I got a call from Speaker Foley's office. For months, the Speaker hadn't returned my calls asking for a chance to introduce myself as a new member. Now it seemed that the Speaker had finally found time to meet with me, but apparently not much. I was told that Foley would soon be leaving his office to walk over to the House floor, and if I wanted to talk with the Speaker, I should hustle over to the Capitol and walk with him. Well, I decided to decline. I didn't feel like a walk just then. The Ethics Committee took up the matter, and I was skeptical from the beginning of their investigation. It seemed to me that this was just a way of keeping everything in-house. On April 1, 1992, they published a list of the top 22 check bouncers and probably hoped that would be the end of it. But we fought for full disclosure, and finally, some 2 weeks later, the list of all members who had bounced checks at the House Bank was released. Hardly anybody was spared. Speaker Foley was on the list, as was the number two Democrat, Gephardt. 19 different committee chairmen had overdrafts on their accounts. Democratic Representative Jerry Sikorsky of Minnesota was one of the worst check bouncers, having written nearly 700 bad checks from his account. He tried to pawn off the blame on his wife. Real classy move. Plenty of House Republicans were on the list too, including two rising stars, Newt Gingrich of Georgia and Vim Weber of Minnesota. Weber chose not to run for re-election, but Newt stuck it out. The hapless Buzz Lukens, who had held my seat in Ohio's 8th District before resigning over an improper relationship with a minor, was sent back to jail, this time for bribery, as a result of the House Bank investigation. Charlie Rose, a long-serving congressman from North Carolina, not the former journalist, used to say that the House was run like the last plantation in America, meaning that members who ran the place, especially the leadership and the committee chairs, were lords and masters of their own self-contained domain. Nobody, least of all American taxpayers, could tell them how to do things differently on their turf. And he was absolutely right. The House Bank scandal was the first shock to that system. After that, people began taking more notice of how deep the rot went in the institution of the House. On March 26, 1992, as the bank scandal was unwinding, veteran Washington Post columnist Jack Anderson described the image of Congress that fiddles while Rome burns. Congress runs up the national debt and gets free overdraft protection at the House Bank, Anderson observed. Congress eats salmon for lunch for under $10 while America is brown bagging it. He pretty much hit the nail square on the head. And here's another reason I knew I had power. After the bank issue blew wide open, my phone never stopped ringing. People were coming out of the woodwork to tip off my office about other little perks and freebies that were hidden away in the House of Representatives system. Some were burrowed in so deep that there was no way any investigation would have uncovered them. A lot of these tips were anonymous. Some were cranks. But some of them turned out to be legitimate. The cheap gourmet lunches Jack Anderson wrote about, those were the specialties of the House restaurant, which soon became another target of our reform efforts. At the time, the restaurant was run by the House itself, as opposed to an outside catering firm on contract. That meant they could get away with a lot more. Only members and guests they sponsored could eat there. While it was used by outside groups a fair amount, the sponsoring members were ultimately responsible for making sure outsiders' tabs got paid. We got a tip that the stack of unpaid bills at the House restaurant had reached the neighborhood of about $60,000. Before long, we had receipts to prove it. That was all unpaid-for food, prepare a taxpayer expense for members and their pals. We gave all of our colleagues formal notice that if these tabs weren't paid off in 30 days, the rest of the information would be disclosed. Well, they got the message. Within 30 days, every dime was repaid. Then there were all the other problems with the House Post Office, informally known as the Congressional Post Office. Members would buy stamps, charge them to their office account, then use them as currency in an underground congressional black market. Stamps would be traded for cash. Under federal law, you can't sell your stamps back to the government. But some members were getting away with it. One way the stamps were laundered, so the rumors went, was through late-night poker games where they would play in stamps. Thousands of dollars worth of USPS stamps were apparently changing hands. And you couldn't just buy stamps at the House Post Office. Apparently, you could buy cocaine, too. You couldn't make this stuff up. No wonder people were sick of Congress. This place was being run like the side streets of Mexico City. Several investigations were opened into the House Post Office, including by the Capitol Police, the House Administration Committee, and the Postal Service itself. Eventually, the House Postmaster was charged and pled guilty, which in turn threw light on the involvement of two members, Joe Coulter of Pennsylvania and Dan Rostenkowski of Illinois, and one staffer. All three of them were charged, but only Rostenkowski, or Rosty as I knew him, I got sent to jail. That was a tough one. Rosty was a good friend, a good member, and a good man. But he was also one of the last of the old-school big-city politicians. Rosty exemplified the Chicago way, and he played by different rules than the rest of us. Now, here I was having to go on TV as the point man for the House reformers, arguing that Rosty deserved to go to jail. Sometimes they booked me and Democrat Representative Charlie Rangel of New York, another old-school, big-city political veteran, and have him defend Rosty. It was hard coming down on my friend from Illinois, but it's what we had to do. Both Rangel and Rosty grew up in a political system with a set of rules that went back to the 1950s. Obviously, the rules had changed quite a bit over the decades, but these guys hadn't. They weren't bad people. They just operated under different rules than what society was going to accept 40 years later. So Rosty paid the price. And a little more than a decade later, so did Rangel, when he was censured for violating House ethics rules. It wasn't personal with Rosty or the guys who bounced checks at the House bank or anybody else who got caught up in the reform efforts of the 1990s. Right was right, wrong was wrong, and something had to be done about all the mess. And those of us who found ourselves out in front of it, the freshmen of the so-called Gang of Seven, quickly became despised by our colleagues, Republican and Democrat alike. To the leadership, we were toxic. Some members would come up to me in the hallways and say, "Boehner, what are you screwing up today?" Often they used less polite language than that. Others wouldn't even look at me at all while they shoveled past. But they were afraid of us. I'd been a member of Congress for about 10 minutes, and I was the guy that mattered. I don't say that as a boast. It was just true. When a member of Congress saw me, or one of my boys, walking their way, they looked like they wanted to either strangle us on sight or jump under their desk. But I was kind of used to my colleagues hating me, so I kept right on going. I'd been elected to office to do something, and now I had the power to get people on my side. That was what led me, as a freshman member in 1992, to sue the House of Representatives in federal district court. I had retained outside counsel, and the general counsel of the clerk of the House was representing the legislative body. I was joined in the suit by about 24 other current members, and needless to say, we were not popular amongst our colleagues. They were pissed enough about losing out on free money and free meals, and just a few months before, I had been part of the effort to ratify the 27th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which made it harder for members of Congress to increase their own salaries. Now they were trying to do just that through the backdoor method of a cost-of-living adjustment, called a COLA for short. This seemed like a sneaky way to violate the very amendment the Congress and the American people had just supported. Despite the grumbled objections of some senior representatives, Congress had made a show of agreeing with the new constitutional amendment, but now they were trying to raise their own salaries on the sly. So I took my own legislative body to court. As strange as it may sound, the story started all the way back in 1789. The Bill of Rights, as most Americans know, and every American should, is made up of the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, and they clearly lay out the fundamental rights and freedoms of every citizen. Originally, though, there were 12 amendments proposed for the first round of additions to our founding document. Two didn't make the cut. One of these, written by James Madison himself, read simply, "No law varying the compensation for the services of senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened." This just means that if members of Congress vote to give themselves a raise, that raise couldn't take effect until after the next congressional election. That way, it's left up to the American people to determine whether or not to vote them back into office to enjoy it. In a June 1789 speech in Congress, Madison observed that there is a seeming impropriety in leaving any set of men without control to put their hands into the public coffers, to take out money to put in their pockets. That made sense then, and it made sense more than 200 years later. But at the time, his colleagues were less than enthusiastic. Only 6 states, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, Delaware, Virginia, Vermont, initially ratified the amendment. It stayed mostly forgotten for nearly 2 centuries. But since there was no time limit given for ratification, it still had the potential to become part of the Constitution if a total of 38 states ratified it. Ohio was the only state to do so in the whole 19th century, in 1873. Wyoming got around to do it in 1978, but things really took off in 1982 when a University of Texas student named Gregory Watson got a C on a government class paper that argued for the amendment's ratification. Watson took on the cause and started a nationwide campaign to raise awareness about this common sense amendment and build up grassroots support. As a result, more and more state legislatures ratified the amendment through the 1980s. By the time I took office in 1991, the amendment had been ratified by 35 states, though technically it was 36. Kentucky originally ratified it in 1792, but apparently everyone, including the Kentucky legislature, forgot about it until the mid-1990s. Three more were needed. The grassroots work was amazing, but in Washington, the idea still needed to gain traction. I knew that this provision belonged in the Constitution. It was the right thing to do for Congress itself to get involved, to show its support for fiscal responsibility. It was time to play some politics. The older members of Congress weren't happy about this. They didn't want any obstacles to raising their own pay when they felt like it. But I figured that the newer members, my fellow freshmen, would feel differently. A bunch of us had a different, more modern perspective on how the House should be run, and we had the momentum to change things. Plus, it wasn't a bad way to make our mark as reformers early on. The Capitol Hill newspaper Roll Call asked me about it at the time, and I told them, "We believe if you're going to have real reform, you must push from the bottom up. Once you're here three or four terms, you have a vested interest in the way things are run." Counting on my classmates paid off. In August 1991, when I sponsored a resolution in support of the 27th Amendment, every one of my fellow Republican freshmen signed on. So did a substantial number of Democrats in the class of 1990. Even our class independent, Representative Bernie Sanders of Vermont, jumped on board, honoring his home state's ratification of the original amendment back in 1791. Still, the resolution only got 59 co-sponsors, less than 14% of the total House membership. There was serious resistance to this idea. Meanwhile, I was helping out the grassroots efforts. I worked with state legislators. I wrote letters. In May 1992, the deal was done. Alabama and Missouri ratified on May 5th. And Michigan clinched it on May 7th. You could practically hear the harumping from the House leadership. Democrat Speaker Tom Foley of the state of Washington groused about challenging the ratification in court. Representative Don Edwards, a Democrat from California, who chaired the Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution and who had made a name for himself promoting civil rights legislation, complained to the New York Times. If James Madison had been interested in this provision, he would have put it in the Constitution. He was sitting there the whole time. But a week later, the archivist of the United States, in charge of officially adding new amendments to the Constitution, announced that the ratification process had been carried out properly, and he would approve it. That, plus the overwhelming support of the amendment from the American people, took the wind out of Foley's sails. He admitted at a press conference, "As a practical matter, it will be considered part of the Constitution." A few days later, on May 20th, the House and Senate both passed resolutions to recognize the new amendment. Congress had agreed to limit its ability to pay itself more money, an effort spearheaded by the House Republican freshmen. But the fight wasn't over yet. In 1992, once the excitement over adding the newest constitutional amendment had died down, Congress tried to raise its pay again with a so-called cost of living adjustment under the Ethics Reform Act of 1989. Passed before my fellow freshmen and I had arrived. This was when we decided to take Congress to court, arguing that they violated the amendment they had just approved. Boehner versus Anderson was decided on December 16, 1992, by Judge Stanley Sporkin of the U.S. District Court in D.C. It did not go my way. Judge Sporkin declared that the court finds that any pay raise stemming from the Ethics Reform Act of 1989 unquestionably meet the requirements of the 27th Amendment. It might be worth noting that federal judges get the same pay as members of Congress, and typically there's a provision that allows the Congress to give federal judges the same raise that members of Congress give themselves. Anyway, the opinion ripped me to shreds. I didn't win that one, but the 27th Amendment is still in the Constitution. Not many members of Congress can say they've been part of the time-honored amendment process laid down by the founders. This is something that no one can take away. It was a humbling experience and an educational one for a freshman member still learning how the D.C. game was played. I knew we were doing the right thing for the right reason, but that didn't mean we couldn't flex some political muscle to get it done. Having that kind of power was a scary and also heady feeling. We confronted folks who were using power for misguided ends, while we were using it for what I thought were good ends. But I could feel the tug. That tug comes to anyone with any authority. People were listening to me now. There was always some voice that can pop in your head. That says something like, maybe I can use this power to destroy anyone I don't like. Maybe I could use it to get something I want for myself. Maybe I can use it as blackmail. You can see how people went down this road. But I tried to be sparing with power and not make examples of people, no matter how pathetic they appeared, such as when a city member of Congress ended up on his knees in my office, begging forgiveness. This was Mark Meadows, a founder of the so-called Freedom Caucus, whom I had first met when he was running for Congress in 2012. Just one of hundreds I campaigned for over the years. I was doing a swing through North Carolina supporting Mitt Romney's campaign for president. This was back in the days when Mitt was the next great conservative hope, before the rabble-rousers decided he wasn't a big enough lunatic for their liking. After speaking at a Romney rally in Asheville, I made time to stop by one of Meadows' campaign events as well. He was grateful to have my support. That was just part of my job. Meadows went on to win a race, and that's when he became my problem. When Meadows showed up in D.C., one of the very first things he did to thank me for campaigning for him was to vote against my re-election as Speaker. His vote wasn't much of a surprise, since none of those Freedom Caucus folks ever seemed to know how to keep their mouth shut. I knew there was a small group getting together to vote against me because they had decided I was some kind of left-wing accommodationist or something. Meadows' name was on the list. You may find it hard to believe, but I didn't bear him any ill will. At least he had the courtesy to knife me in the front. And I still won. He was far from the first person to work in Congress for a day and a half, in his case literally, then decide they were an expert on how to run the place. Not long after the vote, a vote that, like many of the Freedom Caucus's efforts, ended in abject failure, I was told that Meadows wanted to meet me one-on-one. That was no problem. I had made it clear to my staff I would meet with any member anytime. So we set up the meeting. I didn't have a clue what he wanted. Meadows came into my office in the U.S. Capitol, sat down on the couch across from me. We couldn't have talked for more than a second or two, and before I knew it, he had dropped off the couch and was on his knees, right there on my rug. Now that was a first. His hands came together in front of him as if he were about to pray. "Mr. Speaker, please forgive me," he said, or words to that effect. I was so startled, I can't remember exactly what the hell he was saying. For a moment, I wondered what his elite and uncompromising band of Freedom Caucus warriors would have made of their star organizer on the verge of tears, but that really wasn't my problem. I hadn't expected any sort of apology and really hadn't expected to see a man huddled on the rug at my feet, so I did the only thing that came to mind. I took a long, slow drag off my Camel cigarette. I let the tension hang there a little. You know, I looked at my pack of Camels on the desk next to me, then I looked down at him and asked, as if I didn't know, "For what?" "Yeah," I said, "I forgive you." But I knew he was carrying a backpack full of knives, and sooner or later, he'd try to cut me again with them. Which, of course, he did. The funny thing is that Mark Meadows was not the only guy I campaigned for who ended up trying to shiv me once they came to Washington. Take another member of Congress, this one from Florida, by the name of Daniel Webster. As I think about it, having a name like that linked to an historic figure is almost a natural in running for office. But believe me, the same name is the only similarity the two men ever had. Of course, Webster showing up to be a pain in my ass was kind of my fault in the first place. Years before, when it was known that he was considering a run for Congress, I was down in Florida for a fundraiser. Webster was there, too, and while we didn't get to meet, other people had pointed him out and said good things about this former Speaker of the Florida House and then state senator. So on my ride was leaving, I saw Webster walking off by himself. I put the window down the back of the Suburban and shouted, "Webster, for God's sake, run!" We had a few follow-up phone calls where I helped convince him to make a bid for the U.S. House, which he did in 2010. By 2015, he was running against me for Speaker, and then later against Paul Ryan, too. You can never tell with people. Then there are times when you find, despite a title or seniority or ranking in the hierarchy, that the person across from you has more power than you do. They just wield it in a way you may not expect. There was another one-on-one meeting with another kooky member that went very differently. When Michelle Bachmann took her seat in Congress in 2007, she had already made a name for herself as a lunatic. While a member of the Minnesota Senate, she cautioned that showing kids the Disney movie Lion King was normalization of homosexuality because a gay man, Elton John, did the songs. In 2009, she suggested it was an interesting coincidence that swine flu had broken out under one Democrat in the 1970s, Jimmy Carter, and then cropped up again under another Democrat, Barack Obama. It wasn't factually true, but that never stopped someone when they were on a roll. When she first came to town, Bachmann was largely a bomb thrower, complaining about a lot of nonsense to get attention. I don't know how many people paid attention to her. I barely did. She was a kook, no doubt about it, but not the only one. There had always been a few of them around. In 2010, the situation changed. Suddenly, the kooks were joined by a whole bunch of new friends who had helped Republicans retake the House majority. The Kings, the Gohmerts, and Bachmanns who prepared the way, and in their view, were only too happy to welcome the new arrivals. And they weren't above taking advantage of the situation for themselves. I generally had a good read on my folks in the Republican conference, but in this case, I didn't see her coming. Bachmann came to meet with me in the busy period in late 2010 after the election, as we were getting ready to take over the majority. That would mean a reshuffling of committee seats, and she wanted a seat on the Ways and Means Committee, the most powerful committee in the House. She had a few years of seniority at this point, but there were still a number of members in line ahead of her for a post like this. People who had waited patiently for their turn, and who also, by the way, weren't wild-eyed crazies. There was no way she was going to get on Ways and Means, the most prestigious committee in Congress, and jump ahead of everyone else in line. Not while I was Speaker. The idea she could have even asked seemed strange. In earlier days, a member of Congress in her position wouldn't have even dared ask for something like this. Sam Rayburn would have laughed her out of the city. I told her no, diplomatically, of course. But as she kept on talking, it dawned on me. This wasn't a request of the Speaker of the House. This was a demand. Her particular circle of crazy had gotten a lot bigger in the years since she first came to Congress, and she was kind of a folk hero of the freak show set, and she had no problem letting me know it. Her response to me was calm and matter-of-fact. Well, then I'll just have to go talk to Sean Hannity and everybody at Fox, she said, and Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levin, and everybody else on radio, and tell them this is how John Boehner is treating people who made it possible for Republicans to take back the House. I wasn't the one with power, she was saying. I just thought I was. She had the power now. She was right, of course. She was a conservative, media darling, and by then the conservative media was already eyeing me skeptically. More on that later. In Washington speak, I was in an untenable position. More frankly, she had me where it hurt. It wasn't even a decision I could make on my own. The Speaker doesn't have a hand of God power to place whoever he wants on whatever committee he wants, at least not these days. That power belongs to a little-known but very important group called the Steering Committee. The Steering Committee has about 35 members, including the party leadership, members drawn from all the regions of the country. If there's a real power behind a throne in the House, it's the Steering Committee. They are the ones who decide which of their fellow members get to sit on which committees. I had a lot of influence, of course. And I guess if I pulled out all the stops, I might have gotten my way. But I wasn't about to do that for her anyway. I knew there was no way the Steering Committee would approve Bachmann on Ways and Means. The votes just weren't there. And even if I pushed the issue, they wouldn't have let me leave the meeting without fastening me to a straitjacket. But then, Bachman wouldn't go on TV and radio to explain the nuances of House Steering Committee procedure. She just ripped my head off every night over and over and over again. That was a headache I frankly didn't want or need. But then a solution presented itself. The House Intelligence Committee is a permanent select committee, which means the party leaders can personally appoint the members. They get approved as a slate by the whole House Republican Conference, but they don't have to go through the steering committee. And Intel, as the committee is known, deals with serious issues and gives their members solid chops to talk about national security, which puts them in demand for media appearances whenever some global flashpoint gets hot. It also is a good perch for anyone wanting to build up their foreign policy chops for a run for president, which she was already considering, Lord help us all. I suggested that committee to Bachman as an alternative, and mercifully, she liked it. The man preparing to take up the gavel as chairman of the Intelligence Committee was Representative Mike Rogers from Michigan, an Army veteran who also served in the FBI in Chicago in the Organized Crime and Corruption Division. He was a straight shooter, a true professional, and not somebody who could be pushed around. You can imagine how he reacted when I went to him and told him, next year, your committee is going to have a new member, and explaining who it was. I thought he was going to rip my head off. But the choice was between Rogers ripping my head off once and Bachman ripping it off every night on TV for God knows how long. So I took my lumps from Rogers, and Bachman took her seat on the committee. The funny thing is, Michelle Bachman turned out to be a very focused, hardworking member, even though she spent a few months later in 2011 on a short-lived campaign for president. She showed up to the committee, did her homework, ended up winning over her fellow members with her dedication. Mike Rogers was impressed, and I have to admit, so was I. The whole situation ended up working out well for everyone. As one of those old Boehnerisms go, get the right people on the bus and help them find the right seat. The Bachman and Meadows maneuvers, theirs and mine, demonstrated the varying ways people can wield power, successfully and not. What I never wanted to do was wield it the way some of the leaders before me had. I saw the way earlier House Republican leaders like Tom DeLay and Dennis Hastert and their hand-picked committee chairman ran the show. They thought they ruled the roost and they were entitled to feast on taxpayer-provided pork barrel spending. To protect their spoils, they imposed an autocratic, top-down system on the rest of us that didn't sit right with me from the beginning. One day, in my first term, I saw just how far some members would go when they felt their share of the spoils was threatened. Representative Don Young of Alaska is a tough old son of a bitch. When I say tough, I mean tough. The kind of tough that only comes from living in the last frontier for nearly as long as it's been a state in the Union. The kind of tough that earns you the right to cover the walls of your Washington office with the heads and pelts of wild animals you bagged in the woods and mountains. And when I say old, I mean old. Representative Young first came to Congress from Alaska in 1973. He became Dean of the House, the longest-serving member in the chamber, in December of 2017. In March of 2019, he passed another milestone and became the longest-serving Republican in the history of the House of Representatives, breaking the record held by former Speaker Joseph Gurney Cannon, who retired in 1923. If you're going to survive to be old, in Washington or in Alaska for that long, you've got to be a real hard ass. At some point during my freshman term, we were on the floor of the House and I was making one of a whole lot of speeches I made over my career calling out members for making earmarks. I told the people in Ohio's 8th District during my first campaign, if they wanted somebody to go to Washington just to steer money their way, they should find somebody else to send. When they sent me anyway, I thought I would do my best to make life hell for other members, Democrats and Republicans, who just couldn't seem to live without this pork barrel spending. Don Young was one of those members with a special talent for bringing home the bacon, so to speak, to Alaska. He had a whole state to look out for, so I could understand his point of view. Members fought for those crumbs tooth and nail, or in Young's case, with a 10-inch knife. He didn't like what I had to say about earmarks. It certainly wasn't complimentary. As I finished my speech and walked up from the well to the floor, where the main podium stand in front of the speaker's rostrum, I saw Don marching toward me. I didn't know him well, but I could see that he didn't exactly have a smile on his face. Before I knew what was happening, he had shoved me up against the wall of the house chamber, pulled a 10-inch knife from his pocket. He was known for carrying one or more knives everywhere he went, flipped the blade open, and held it up to my throat. "Don't you ever do that again," he growled. I didn't have the time to think about any of this in the heat of the particular moment, but there are certain defining moments in Congress, as in life, that force you to decide what kind of person you're going to be. Are you going to be your own man, or are you going to be part of the flock of cackling chickens following behind whoever is in charge, tossing out the feed? Don Young was no cackling chicken, and I sure as hell wasn't going to be either. The way I figured, if God sent me to the House of Representatives to end up getting gutted like a dead caribou by a wild man from Alaska in the middle of the chamber, then hey, there were worse ways to go. I looked Don right square in the eye and said, "Fuck you." He quickly took the knife away from my throat and we went our separate ways. The whole thing was over in a matter of seconds and it was still out of the range of C-SPAN cameras. Still, the story has bounced around Washington ever since. The funny thing was that, despite this unusual getting acquainted meeting, or maybe because of it, I don't know, Don and I actually ended up becoming good friends. I was the best man at his wedding, where I told the knife story for probably the 1,000th time. As Don likes to say nowadays, each and every time you tell this story, Boehner, the knife gets a little bigger and gets a little bit closer. Well, I know what I saw. Sometimes I still feel that thing right against my throat. The real moral of the story is that there was something very wrong with a system that made good, upstanding U.S. representatives fight like wild dogs over leftover scraps of taxpayer money. And the rot went deep. That's why the first thing I did as Speaker was get rid of earmarks for good. It wasn't just about the money. The money itself wasn't the corrupting influence. It was the power. As I ended up in the leadership myself as conference chairman and got to see more of the system up close, it only soured me more. Nobody made these people God. They had no right to act like it. And this attitude filtered down from the leadership to the chairman of the individual committees. Throughout my career, I was struck by what a little power could do to people's heads. I saw perfectly decent, rational members get appointed chairman of a committee and then turn into autocrats. They turned into somebody you didn't even recognize. It all went to their heads. I could name names here, but I won't. The point is, you never know how power is going to change people. So I decided that, if I ever got the chance, I was going to do things differently. When I became a leader in the House, I sure as hell made sure that I didn't turn into one of those power-mad assholes that kept the system of abuses going in the first place. Only on rare occasions did I give my approval for actions punishing individual members. And even then, it wasn't about punishing that certain member, but protecting the team as a whole. For instance, the House Steering Committee, as I mentioned earlier, could put members on committees. But they could boot them off, too. They wanted to use their power to weaken members who made it their brand to vote against the leadership. There were always people like that who thought the easy and cheap way to look like a maverick or a reformer was to stand against whoever was in charge on almost anything. I say this with some irony, since I was one of those people who went against the leadership during the House bank scandal. But I did it for what I felt were the right reasons, though I guess some of these people who became nuisances to me felt the same way. In some cases, the steering committee did carry out punishments. Tea Party or Tim Muehlkamp from Kansas, so-called libertarian Justin Amash from Michigan, ex-Democrat Walter Jones of North Carolina, and Dave Schweikert from Arizona, who kept his seat by knocking off a fellow Republican member in an especially nasty primary, all of them ended up losing committee assignments. That wasn't my idea, however. In fact, I often thought it was a bad idea. And I argued to the steering committee that it would just help them with their brand building by making these guys into bigger martyrs and giving them a platform to fundraise with outside right-wing groups and take pot shots at party leadership and the media. But the will of the steering committee and the rest of the leadership was clear, and I signed off on it. I can understand their logic, too. These guys were actively hurting the team, so why should the team continue to help them? Let them whine about it. They go soak their heads. Still, there were other ways of dealing with difficult members that I found much more to my style. Most members of Congress, for instance, like to travel. Anything to get outside the Beltway. Members of Congress get to travel all over the world on fact-finding trips called Congressional Delegations, or CODELs for short. They get their pictures taken with foreign leaders. They look like big deals back home. People love to rip on these trips as taxpayer-funded junkets. But take it from the guy who got rid of a lot of lush perks for members of Congress. CODELs are usually worth it. If members are going to be in charge of funding and oversight of American projects around the world, military operations, aid work, business initiatives, it helps to see how these things work firsthand. It helps to know other foreign leaders and to see the United States from their point of view. It's also a good idea to see for yourself if things abroad are working out the way a president or secretary of state says they are. Not to say that you can't have some fun seeing the world with your colleagues too, but there will be time for CODEL stories later on. The committee chairs and leadership determined who got to go in CODELs, and there was often a long list of people interested. Sometimes when I made the determination that a certain member was acting in a way that was hurting the team or just being a total jackass, I had to make a tough decision. On a few of those occasions, I went to the committee chairs and made it clear that it wouldn't be a problem for me if we basically lost their plane ticket. Sometimes I said it more directly than that. I wouldn't go to the press or make a big announcement about how I punished someone or trash-talked anybody. It was more subtle than that. I just made my decision clear to a few key people, and the knuckleheads never got to go on CODELs, period. Of course, the biggest institutional power of the Speaker of the House is by far the ability to decide which bills make it to the floor and which don't. The actual scheduling of the floor calendar is handled by the Majority Leader, the person on the rung directly under me in the leadership ladder. That's what it says on paper. But trust me, nothing came to the floor for a vote unless I said it was coming to the floor. Members of the Knucklehead Caucus figured that out real quick. The bills on the floor reflected the priorities of the whole team. If these folks didn't want to be on the team, why should the team support their bill? Some of them got the message, some didn't. It was fine either way by me. The role of Speaker has an important ceremonial aspect, too. The greatest expression of this is the President's annual State of the Union address to Congress, where the powers of the legislative and executive branch collide. It's a logistical nightmare to pull off. Getting all of the members of the House and Senate, plus the Cabinet and Supreme Court justices, and everybody else into the same place. Once during the George W. Bush years, I got to the floor late, a rare occasion for me, and I couldn't find a seat. I was still looking out into the chamber to see if I could spot one when Bush took the podium, and I didn't want to have my back turned toward the president, so I just turned around and sat down right there in the aisle. And naturally, it made it into the next day's paper. Once I became Speaker, of course, I had a direct role in the State of the Union proceedings and couldn't afford any screw-ups like that. It was easily the hardest night of my year. There I would sit for an hour and a half next to Uncle Joe Biden, staring straight at the back of President Obama's head. Those occasions were all about the president, not the vice president or me or anybody else, and I knew that if I did anything, made even one off-kilter facial expression, or God forbid, yawned, the camera would catch it and I'd get roasted. So I would stare at the back of the president's head. I could almost tell you how many hairs President Obama had back there. I did my best to make no expression whatsoever. Usually that worked out all right. But even that wasn't good enough for some people. One reporter once said, "I look bored." Inside, I was making every facial expression known to man. There were plenty of times Obama said things I didn't agree with or took jabs at Republican priorities, but rolling my eyes or shaking my head would have been totally unprofessional. At least that's what I thought. Apparently, the new tradition enacted by Speaker Pelosi is ripping up her copy of the president's speech. Now, that's a good 180 degrees from how I do things, but everyone has their style, I guess. The first year I sat for the State of the Union as Speaker was 2011. Biden and I had a meeting about a week before, and I made a suggestion. "Joe," I said, "we're going to stop all this jumping up and down and clapping, where one side of the aisle tries to outdo the other. We've got to bring this to a stop. It's become an annoying tradition at these speeches and strictly partisan standing ovations. Maybe we should lead by example, I offered. The two of us shouldn't hop up and clap for everything the president says. Biden seemed fine with that, so maybe I thought this year's address would actually have some semblance of order to it. On the night itself, I was standing at the podium, and everybody was walking in, senators, ambassadors, all the rest. Biden came up to take his place next to me, and I immediately started telling him about a fantastic golf game I'd had out in the sandhills of Nebraska a few months before. I was walking him through my round of the decade. I shot 72, until one of my staff came running over to tell me my mic was live. Turned out the mic at the president's spot was switched on already and picked up every word of our conversations. All I could think of was, thank God we were talking about golf. Just before the speech started, Biden turned to me and said, you know, I'm going to have to stand up sometimes. You know, maybe the boss had got wind of our plan. I told him I understood, of course, but for the rest of the night, every time Obama delivered an applause line, Biden would shoot me a quick, apologetic glance that seemed to say, is it okay for me if I stand up now? Well, the last thing I wanted to do was to get Uncle Joe in trouble with the president. He and I had a long-standing relationship. Biden was a classic old-school Paul, maybe one of the last of the breed. We were pretty close, always friendly, could count on each other to be honest all the time, something that's rarer in Washington or anywhere else. Whether it's the scene of grand rhetoric or a partisan rallying cry, the State of the Union is, in many ways, a strange American institution. On the one hand, it's mostly empty theater these days. Everybody pretty much knows what the president's going to say. The members of the president's party in Congress will get up and cheer, and the opposition will sit on their hands, stone-faced, or at least hopefully not shout anything. It's just a show for the TV cameras. On the other hand, only a president can command that kind of attention. The greatest power at the president's disposal is not the world's most powerful military force or an arsenal of nuclear weapons capable of destroying the world several times over. It's the power of the soapbox. The president of the United States has the biggest soapbox in the world, which, if used correctly, can shape and form national and even international opinion. How a president uses that platform is critically important to their success. Effective communication is key to projecting real power. Most of our modern presidents have understood that. President Obama was very good at it. Even though I disagree with most of what he said, I can admit that he was a great communicator. So was Bill Clinton. He was a fantastic talker. Just ask Newt about his ties. More on that later. And a master of the bully pulpit. George W. Bush also was able to use power effectively, but in different ways. Bush was certainly underrated as a communicator, and he had a phenomenal partner in Dick Cheney. They were a great team who understood how to use the power of their office to advance their agenda in a way that they believed would help the country. President Trump had a hard time using the world's largest soapbox in a way that benefited the country or even himself. As everyone knows by now, he often preferred to communicate by tweet, which on many occasions got in the way of his own goals. Early on, the economy performed admirably, and the administration logged some major policy wins, like tax cuts. Of course, the 2020 pandemic was something nobody anticipated. But all along the way, the president's continual tweeting threatened to undermine his own success. The bully pulpit for the Speaker of the House is pretty small by comparison, but it is still an office outlined in detail in the Constitution. That makes it more than just a partisan position. How one chooses to balance those roles, however, depends on the Speaker, himself or herself. That was another difference between me and Speaker Pelosi. When I was minority leader and she was Speaker, I watched how she handled the office. We obviously came from different parties and we were different sorts of people, but if I wanted a shot at leading my party to the majority, I figured I'd learn all I could, and sometimes I'd learned what not to do. One thing I learned watching Speaker Pelosi was that saying a lot of words is not the same thing as communicating. In my view, she spoke on the floor too often. Her speeches could be long-winded. That helped me understand that if I was going to go on the floor, it had better be about something important. As Speaker, I thought it better to hold my fire most of the time. I wasn't going to add my voice on any old bill, even if I supported it. If there was a need for me to speak on something, I'd do it. But when I did, I'd get up and say what I had to say, then shut up and sit down. I didn't think being speaker gave me any special opportunity to go over time limits and crowd out other members. Some colleagues from both parties seemed to think that the longer they talk, the more points they were making. But I never bought into that. Long-windedness to me is a power wasted. I learned a great saying very early on in Congress from Texas Representative Larry Combest in 1992. We sat on the House Agriculture Committee together. Combest had been a former staffer for Senator John Tower. And one day in the House cloakroom, he told me a favorite saying of Tower's: "You never get in trouble for something you don't say." I've never forgotten that to this day. It's helpful for most people to remember in both their professional and personal lives. The tighter you try to cling to power, the easier the hold can sometimes be to break. I saw Speaker Pelosi's iron grip on power backfire, ultimately bringing the Republicans back into the majority. Between January 2009 and the November 2010 midterm elections, she worked hand in glove with President Obama to pass two major pieces of legislation: the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, and the American Clean Energy and Security Act, or, as we called it, cap and trade. The House Democrat Party had to be fully behind these bills. Speaker Pelosi would tolerate no dissensions in her ranks. I saw pro-life Democrat Bart Stupak of Michigan hold his nose and vote for Obamacare because he was promised changes that never came. He decided to step down in 2010. I saw pro-coal Democrat Rick Boucher, who represented a coal-producing district in southwestern Virginia, vote for cap and trade, one of the most anti-coal bills in recent memory. He lost in 2010 to a pro-coal Republican. In a sad twist for Democrats, it was their moderates who lost the worst in the 2010 elections. Moderate Democrat seats swinging to Republicans helped us take back the House. I never forgot that lesson, and I knew I wasn't going to endanger our majority by forcing controversial legislation through at ramming speed. I just couldn't work that way. I'd let everyone have their say, and when the majority of the conference was committed to a course, we'd go ahead. And those who didn't get their way just had to deal with it, which to them often meant running and crying to the right-wing press. Consensus rarely meant unanimity, but that was fine with me. I just wanted to keep the decision-making process open, and I did that all the way through. It was more open than any Congress I'd ever worked in. And most of the members felt that way too. Even if they didn't always agree with me, they appreciated the chance to hear what was going on and then have their say. Mitch McConnell, for instance, has a very different approach, and the Senate is a very different beast. Now, these points were made very clear to me by the man himself. McConnell is one of the best politicians I've ever met. He's incredibly smart. You get the impression he's always playing a game of risk inside the safe confines of his brain. He's always winning. He's made a living out of being inscrutable. He holds his feelings, his thoughts, emotions in a lockbox closed so tightly that whenever one of them seeps out, bystanders are struck silent. To McConnell, information is power, and he holds it close. He keeps his cards so close to his vest his members don't get to see them until he's ready. And even then, they only see the corner that he shows them. Mitch and I had a great working relationship. His staff got along with my staff, and rest assured, the guy was a tough nut to crack. I like to get along with people, have a few drinks, a few laughs, and to not always make everything about work. Mitch McConnell has a professional facade you cannot shake. It's useless to try to loosen things up with a joke. Maybe, at the most, you'll get the corners of his mouth to twitch into something that could be interpreted as a smile, but you can't be certain. We have different styles for sure. And there's a reason I've stuck to the House and he stuck to the Senate. Maybe his kind of leadership is more what the Senate needs than what would work in the House. But you can always learn something from those who lead differently than you, even if it won't work in your case. In 2006, I was the House Majority Leader and McConnell was the Senate Majority Whip. That meant we were both the number two man on our respective chambers' leadership teams. So we kept in touch frequently, as did our staffs. I didn't know him that well at the time, and despite coming from similar parts of the country, Cincinnati is right on the Kentucky border, we weren't gelling. McConnell came over to my office in the Capitol to see me for one of our regular check-ins. I had some friends in the Senate, several of my pals from the House, like Saxby Chambliss, Richard Burr, Lindsey Graham had moved over there by that time, and generally kept up with gossip from the other side of the Hill. I had a pretty good idea of what was happening over there, and I wanted to make sure that Mitch knew it. I thought he might be impressed that I had the place wired. Well, after my meeting ended, I walked McConnell to the door. I held it open for him, and as Mitch walked out, he stopped. He turned around the doorway and gave me a little lesson in how he viewed our power dynamics and how it was going to work between us. He looked me dead in the eye. "John," he said, with his usual expressionless face, "I'll never presume to know more about the House than you do. And trust me, you'll never know as much about the Senate as I do." And then he turned and was gone. Now, I knew how members of the Senate probably felt whenever they got sideways with their leader. Mitch McConnell had kicked me in the balls. I was stunned. I went back to my office and sat down to think about what I'd done. Like I'd been dressed down by a parent or a teacher, and Mitch is not that much older than I am, he certainly got his message across. I never again made the mistake of acting like I knew the Senate. He was the powerful one, and I was just a mere observer. Even if I wanted to, I could never operate like Pelosi did. The fact was, I didn't want to act that way, even though sometimes other people thought I should. A lack of transparency might work in the Senate, but it would never fly in the House, no matter how nasty things got. As Speaker, when I was dealing with members who were not only going against the team, but also trashing the team to the press, I'd have staff and other members chastising me every day. "Boehner, you gotta be meaner," they'd say. I'd have to explain to them, I just don't have a mean bone in my body. I just don't do mean. It's a waste of energy. I couldn't be mean to somebody if I tried. And I have no interest in trying. It's just not who I am. Which probably means I ought to get around to telling you a little bit about where I came from.